for AM 1290.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Deckers, makers of Uggs and Tevas, Pierre LaFon Wendy Foster offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines, Montecito Bank and Trust proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years, Habitat for Humanity building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter, and CSU Channel Islands. No matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And we're fortunate enough, speaking of CSU Channel Islands, to have Annie White, who is an assistant professor of early childhood studies at CSU Channel Islands. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what's so interesting to me is I was preparing for this interview, and I was relying on information I have in the back of my head I've gained from going to every one of the Sims Man Fellowship rewards program, and you told me you were last year a fellow.
Yes, I was. It was a great honor to be able to apply and be a recipient of the coveted Sims Man Institute fellowship. So what's happened is the Sims Man Institute has opened it up for fellowship applications from across California, from the community colleges and all of the CSUs, and they selected 13 fellows to participate in creating projects that would impact children birth to 3 years of age.
So this ties into my first question, which is what years, when you have a freshman student, what is the youngest age you'll be teaching a teacher to be a teacher? Is it one? Is it two? Is it zero?
Yeah, great question. So we start from birth, right? Right at birth. And so we teach infant toddler educaring courses that help prepare teachers to work with children right from birth. So the course specifically focuses on birth to three-year-olds. And then we have a preschool courses that also focus specifically in the preschool age and then also school age up to third grade.
And if you remember at the Sims Man Institute last year, February this year, one of the scientists, and they have world-class scientists come every year, was talking about how important in vitro development is. And that is, you know, whether there's music being played or if there's stress, mm-hmm. the mother's experiencing stress. So in a way, education begins even before the baby is born.
Absolutely. Prenatal is an incredible time. That is a very vulnerable time that we need to focus on to ensure healthy development.
Now, some of the schools, when you look at their catalogs, they talk about teaching for, you know, two and three and up. The fact that CSU Channel Islands teaches from birth, is that something that you're on the forefront of, or are more and more schools taking that view?
Yes, more and more schools are taking the view because we know that the most rapid time of early brain development starts right at birth, and the most rapid time of growth is from birth to 3 years of age. And so there are factors that are contributing. It's very, very important that we educate young teachers that are working with this population and that they have the sufficient information, the most current research on what they can do to support healthy brain development.
And outside of the school, there is a need to educate parents. And yeah. Do you provide any type of educational material for community members who are not going for a teaching degree?
Yes, we do provide lots of resources. And part of what our program offers is we provide classes for students to help them learn how to engage with the community, how to engage with parents, how to support parents in a partnership on the behalf of children's education.
So how do we deal with this issue when we have a community? You know, people look at this area and say, well, it's a very rich community, but it actually is not. There is a component, could be as high as 40%, that's at the poverty level. Mm-hmm. And there's a direct correlation between lack of education or lack of being able to learn and economic well-being. So, for example, you know, what happens if the kid's hungry? I mean, how do we deal,
Do you have to be a social worker? What I'm asking is, do you have to be a social worker besides a teacher to deal with these young kids today? Because if the kid doesn't have food and nourishment, it's really impossible to learn, no matter how good the teacher is.
Right. Well, it's a great question, because it's really everybody's responsibility in society to support families and young children. And for example, in Head Start, which has been around for over 50 years, they provide, in addition to educational services, they provide comprehensive services. So they address nutrition, they address social services, they help families with housing, with job search, there's dental homes, there are so many aspects that the Head Start program addresses to support young families. That's just one. And then, of course, in California, we have state preschool programs. Here in Santa Barbara, you have Head Start programs. You have migrant Head Start programs. There's also state preschool programs. So there is quite a population here that it's really a comprehensive program where there's many organizations and agencies working in collaboration to serve the families. You have homeless families in this community that the children attend child care programs that are right here in Santa Barbara.
Unfortunately, this AM signal doesn't go as far as Washington because there really is some long-term negative impact of some of the cuts they're talking about to these programs.
Yeah.
But enough of politics. Besides food, there's home life. How do you engage? Do you teach the teachers how to engage parents that they don't want to be engaged? They have three jobs, or it's one parent.
Yes, family engagement is a central component that we know that is one of the factors that supports and ensures school readiness for young children. So engaging with very busy families is quite a task that teachers have today, because you're right, families are very, very busy. And so one of the things in my research interest, which is based on a formative assessment called Learning Stories, it's from New Zealand, I've figured out a way how to adapt that approach here in California as a way to engage families, a way to connect with families around children's learning and their education. And it's basically a narrative storytelling approach where the teachers will write directly to the child about the observation or what they observe the child do. And that is shared with the family, and then the family can respond back. Well, with the age of technology and being so accessible with so many different mobile devices, we are finding that families are really resonate to these stories written to their child, and they often will respond back. So that's one example of way how we can engage with families in our assessment practices, in observing children, and also for curriculum planning purposes.
But the children don't read this, right? They can't read. I mean, they hear the stories.
So these learning stories, which are written narrative observations, can be printed and put into a portfolio that is down at the kept at the children's level. Or it can also be in an e-portfolio. And so teachers and parents both read these to the children if they can't read. And it's amazing because the children respond, because these are stories written to them. So it supports the learner identity.
So there's another skill set you need to be a teacher now, and that is to be able to put together a declarative sentence without having the verb and the subject in the wrong place. I found that I taught for 12 years at City College here, and I found that one of the really disappointing aspects of young kids coming into college is they may be smart, they may be able to do math, but they couldn't write. And how do you find that? Do you have a need to give these new teachers remedial writing skills?
Well, we're fortunate at CSU Channel Islands. We have a lot of support services for students. We have a high population of students that are transferring or first generation college students. And so we have like a writing literacy center. We have student support services. We have an incredible library staff. There's so many services available to support the students. One of the things is using these mobile devices. So for example, back to the learning stories, which the students do in our courses, they can audio record. They can record if they speak another language than English. It can be translated into their home language back into English. So we find that there is a very fluid exchange, and that the teachers are feel less intimidated by using different types of tools to help them when they do the documentation. Because you're right, when they write these learning stories or they orally record it, this is shared with the family. So there is a lot of emphasis on their written, right, and their oral skills.
So there's no need to be bilingual as a teacher. You even if the child is family is Hispanic, mm-hmm. Spanish-speaking, then mm-hmm. you will write the story in English and it gets translated. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. So it breaks down those barriers. If you're a mono English speaking only teacher, you have this tool for communication. Of course, we know with the research that we want to support the child's first language, especially from birth to three, because that's the time of identity. And we know with research that they retain their language if they speak their home language in the early years.
You're listening to AHA Presents on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Founded by a UCSB grad, Deckers Brands has grown into a global driver of lifestyle footwear from humble beginnings in 1973. Santa Barbara's been a key element of the business, defining the company's culture, providing home base for many employees, and inspiring product innovation each year. For a first-hand experience, stop by the Deckers Brands headquarters in Goleta, 250 Coromar Drive, from 10 to 7, Monday through Saturday, 11 to 5 Sunday, and shop their new brand showcase retail test lab. Guaranteed, you'll see a new side to Deckers' portfolio, from footwear to handbags to home furnishings.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and our guest today is Annie White, an assistant professor of early childhood studies at CSU Channel Islands. And I just read that AHA uses innovative social-emotional learning as an important component. I personally believe, and AHA believes also, that social-emotional learning is so critical. I don't know how you do that as for a 2 or 3 year old, but I know in life that's important to be emotionally intelligent. How do you work that in, or do you work that in with early childhood education?
Yeah, absolutely. Though it's really the foundation for all future learning is in social emotional development. And with very young children, the best and most important thing is developing healthy relationships, because young children, especially babies, infants and toddlers, learn from the interactions, the messages that they get from the adults, both the positive and the negative. So it's the way that they're held, the way that they're cared for, the way that they're responded to, all of those in the routines, the daily routines like feeding or napping or diapering or washing or bathing, all of those they receive messages from. So it's very important that it's in the context of relationships that they learn about themselves, about others, and about the world around them.
Teaching, early childhood teaching has changed almost as much as anything in this society. What do you do with a 60-year-old teacher that learned their methods of teaching, 30, 35 years ago? Mm-hmm. How do you get them to understand that the world doesn't begin in kindergarten? Mm-hmm. And so, if I'm a parent, how do I ensure that I'm getting somebody that really has the new skills that we know now are important?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think having teacher preparation programs like we have, for example.
What does that mean?
Teacher preparation program training, that we have courses to help prepare adults to become teachers or to strengthen those that are already teachers, like we have at CSU Channel Islands is very important. So I think having education is extremely important because you're right. Research tells us so much about brain development, tells us so much what children need for optimal development. And so sometimes having students who may be of an older generation, they come in, but when they hear about the research and when they have the experience in the classes that we teach with these hands-on experiences that we provide, it somehow you hear over and over again that it just clicks, like they get it, like it was something intuitively inside they knew. And so often you see that it that they it's a, an easy transition. We do have an issue, though, in California, for example, across the country, that we have an incredible need for teachers. We have a teacher shortage, and especially infant toddler teachers. It's incredible that in California we have a high turnover rate where teachers leave the field and, you know, low profession, low pay, extremely low pay for this kind of demanding work, you know. Also, the factor that, you know, there's not a lot of benefits that come with it. There's so many factors that create a high turnover for teachers.
Isn't that interesting that if you look at the neuroscience, the early years are probably more important than any other year, and parents in this community will chip in a public school and pay for this and pay for that, but they don't really take much of a notice about the person teaching their two-year-old. Right. And that's sort of the irony of where they should be putting their efforts. So early childhood teachers actually make less than someone teaching eighth grade or ninth grade?
Yes, it's actually very, very much so. There's a very huge discrepancy between early childhood and K through 12 teachers, for example. And it's not uncommon for an early childhood, especially a teacher who maybe works birth to three, for example, or even a preschool teacher, will make less than somebody working at a fast food restaurant.
So why is that?
I think it really comes down to our society not really valuing teachers. And other countries, they supplement the income. Parents cannot afford what really truly it costs for high quality care. It's just not babysitting anymore. High quality care means you have to have educated, well trained teachers. And in society, we don't value it. We don't see our young children as being our number one resource that we should be investing in.
But that answer is true for all ages of students. But why is there a disparity between someone teaching a two-year-old and someone teaching a 12-year-old?
I think because we don't really value that time of development. We don't really see that. And many people don't even know about the rabbit time of brain development. There's research out there saying that when a child is born, just at birth, that their brain is about 25 to 30% the size of an adult brain, and then by age three, it's between 80 to 90% the size of an adult brain. That's an incredible amount of time of rapid development. All other parts of our organs are fully developed at birth except the brain. And then we know one of the main factors for brain development is based in the relationship, the care that is provided. So when you have young teachers, early childhood teachers, interacting, they're planning environments, they're planning the curriculum, they're assessing the children. It's an incredible amount of work that they do. And the group size, depending on what the funding is for the program, some are really at harmful large group size. And so it really needs to be offset by balanced with getting funds also both federally and from the state to help lower those group sizes so we don't have this high turnover rate.
So I want to be a teacher. I'm 19 years old, 18 years old. I just graduated from Santa Barbara High. Why am I going to choose early childhood? If I'm going to be a teacher, why shouldn't I say I'm not going to earn nothing? I could, you know, I'm better off with a four-year degree. I might as well take that degree and teach high school. Well, how do you incentivize these kids?
Right. It is a very tricky because often they may come in and get a degree in early childhood and then they'll see what they're going to make in actuality and then they'll shift and maybe go to higher grades and go into maybe third grade or all the way up to high school. So they'll shift because based on the wages they get. Often what I have found is that those that work in early childhood is because it's truly a passion. They understand the impact that they have. That's not a monetary reward, but there's a much greater good that they're contributing to in society. And there's a real commitment and understanding of the critical need for high quality teachers.
I wish more people would have exposure to the Simsman Institute, because I had no idea that these years are so important. And I remember with my kids who are grown now, you know, really only worried about what college they were going to go to. And the high school that they went to was really just a stepping stone to college. To college. Nobody considered what, you know, even third or second grade was more or less, you know, kindergarten. We chose the early childhood school because it happened to be around the block from our building. It wasn't based upon any great research. So, you know, there really here is a need to, particularly since one of the things that I noticed the government's doing more and more, New York, for example, is providing for early childhood. The question is, where are they going to find the teachers that, you know, that can really take advantage of that?
Right. Well, that's why we feel like in the CSU system that we're the training ground, and that we there's only two of the 23 CSUs that offer an early childhood degree. One is, of course, Channel Islands, where I work, and the other one's Sonoma State. So we are very committed. We know that we're training the future workforce, but there's so many factors that really play into the teachers being ready and trained and available. And I'm very fortunate. I work with a program that is so committed to advancing the workforce.
And do you have, does the school have trouble filling up the classroom with teachers? I mean, teachers are willing to make that investment?
Yeah, we're in our early childhood studies program. There's such an incredible need that we're actually at our maximum capacity at currently, because there's such a need in our community for early childhood teachers. There's so many teachers that are substitutes and they're looking for subs, and there's a huge need.
And when are you going to tell them how much money? You wait until 4 years are over until you tell them how much money they're going to make?
No, we tell them right from the beginning so that they know, because we tell them that you have to have a huge commitment and a deep care to work with young children.
And the degree is different from someone who wants to teach high school. I mean, it's a different a curriculum and a different degree.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not transferable. I mean, you can't, if I decide later in life, later in my career, you have to take the courses that were required for that.
Yes, they're in early childhood. Unfortunately, it's not recognized in California as for a teacher credential. That we've been working on it for many, many years, trying to advocate so that we can have an early childhood teacher credential. That will be one way to raise the wages. Currently, we follow a state matrix, so it's like we have permits, and there's different levels in early childhood, but it's not the same as a teaching credential. And many other countries, of course, they're respected and they're right there and treated equal at the table. And so it's a real issue that we have in early childhood, and we're really advocating, trying to see if we can get that changed so that we could have an early childhood teaching credential.
And what about the gender distribution? I would assume it's mostly women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And are there men?
Yes, there are men in the field, but there's not enough. We have a crisis, low amount of men in early childhood. But we know with the research that how valuable it is. And we also know that there's so many young children, especially underrepresented, low-income children, don't have men in their lives. And so having a male teacher role model, just having men in a child's life makes a great difference. So it's something that we're continuing to advocate for, but we're out of balance with the amount of men, ratio male to female.
So if there's no credentialing and no licensing.
There's a permit.
Permit.
So yes.
So could I have a master's degree in something completely mm-hmm. irrelevant. Could mm-hmm. I teach early childhood?
No, you would still need the classes in early childhood because they're specialized classes. So you can, with a comparable degree, there is a way through the matrix, but you have to take additional classes with that. So we do have a transitional kindergarten permit that we're working with, which is to, if you are, for example, a kindergarten teacher and you want to work in a TK or transitional kindergarten program, or if you're a third grade teacher, you can teach in the TK. There's a process now that we have where you can go and you need 24 additional early childhood units. So it's just one piece of the bigger picture issue of trying to find equality for early childhood teachers.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Available only at the company's headquarters in Goleta, the new Deckers brand showcase features the latest footwear from UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands. You're invited to stop by to experience firsthand what makes Deckers brand so unique. Discover new product and try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand at their retail stores. Now open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coramore Drive in Goleta.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, improving attitude, creating social harmony, bridging the achievement gap for teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here with Annie White, an assistant professor of early childhood studies at CSU Channel Islands. And before we go too far, let's go backwards and let's talk a little bit about you. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I grew up in Berkeley and Oakland, and it was a great experience at the time I lived there.
And you did a lot of protesting?
You know, it was a very, yes, actually I did. It was part of my educational experience. I grew up, protesting and marching to City Hall. That was the norm within my life. And also I remember tanks coming down Telegraph Avenue, as I'm going to school. So it was quite a tumultuous time to grow up.
So you took Protest 101 at Berkeley?
Yes, it was very much a part of our lives, all of us.
So did you go to schools up in elementary schools and early childhood schools up in San Francisco?
It was actually in Berkeley.
Berkeley?
And yes, I went to schools in Berkeley and early childhood, went to what they call back then nursery schools. And I also went kindergarten through seventh grade. It was a very interesting time because at that time they were doing busing. They initiated busing, and they also had a curriculum that was an anti-bias curriculum focus. And so it was a very interesting mix and a time for me to go to school.
And what got you interested in becoming a professional in this business?
You know, I think anybody who really works with early childhood might have a similar experience, but I felt like I was the Pied Piper. I lived in Alaska for many years. I moved from the Bay Area and had little experience, and then I moved up to Alaska.
A lot of people move from San Francisco to Alaska. Well, it's like a major migration.
Well, I had a little
detour.
They
want to get out of the good weather and the sunshine and go up to Alaska.
No. I don't know. I must have been young at the time. So I didn't go straight from there. I had a little detour in my life. But when I did arrive in Alaska, I found like it was like being the Pied Piper. Everywhere I went, children followed me. And, I didn't ever want to work with children because I saw from a very young age how much responsibility it was. But at some point, I surrendered and said, I think this is what I'm meant to do. And that began my journey with young children.
And the journey was in college? Did you take courses in college?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask. So I was, when I went to high school, I had secretly wanted to go to college, but I come from a family. I'm the first person in my family to graduate from college. So that wasn't really part of our vocabulary, but I had this secret desire to go to college. I didn't know how I'd get there because I felt like it was for somebody else's family. It wasn't ours, obviously. And so I had always wanted to go to UC Davis, and it took me 25 years. And I continued to take one class at a time, and I got my doctorate from UC Davis.
In veterinary work, I hope. It's got a great veterinary school.
No, actually, it was in educational leadership.
Luckily, because veterinary work wouldn't be helping you really much.
No, it would not. Yeah. But they have a great leadership and education program. So it was a joint doctorate with UC Davis and Sonoma State. It was a very progressive doctorate program. And I was really excited about that because my journey led me, was very interesting. When I did return and went to my first college class, my instructor turned out to be was the principal of the early childhood program that I attended in Berkeley.
Wow.
And she's still my mentor today. She's in her mid-80s. We just traveled to China last year. We've traveled to Italy together. And she still spins circles around me today.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is if you're an expert in this field, you live longer. Is that one of the selling points? You don't make as much money, but you live longer?
I think, you know, if I look at her name's Marianne Kreshka, she has been such a role model to me because she's visionary and passionate. And she always says there's no time to waste. There's so much work to be done. And so I think when you deeply care about your work, then yes, it rejuvenates you and it definitely feeds you.
So if you had to describe the typical student that's willing to make these sacrifices and do this, how would you describe that student, that freshman coming in?
Yeah, committed, caring, compassionate, knowledgeable, eager, open, and I think often you'll see that they have some kind of their own history in their families, that they might have cared for other children, they might have come from large families. But they have this very caring nature to want to help others.
And were those qualities you had? Did you have an experience dealing with kids when you were?
Yeah, definitely. Wherever I went, I was always caring for children. I went in Alaska, they often had large families, so I might have had a family with 6 children, or somebody with 7 children, or I'd have 3 families, and I'd be with 15 children by myself. And I found that there was just something from within me that was able to really connect with young children. And of course, as I went to school and college, and it took many years, but I just persisted with it, I really knew that that was the right path for me. But what really, I think that I have found really if it's okay to say, like, my life calling or my life interest is really around the learning stories, the narrative assessment approach. I was able to study in New Zealand. I visited there. I went on a study tour, and I heard the co-author of the Learning Stories do a presentation. And there was something about hearing about writing these narrative stories to young children that really resonated with me and caught my interest, because here in California, for state-funded programs, if you get any state dollars, you assess children using a specific tool called the Desired Results Developmental Profile. Most teachers know it as the DRDP. And it was built or developed basically out of the University of Berkeley. And WestEd is overseeing the project. And but in translation for it, what I realize is that teachers here in California are really getting bogged down with this assessment. It's very time-consuming writing all of the observations that you need to use as evidence to rate or score the child. And so looking to learning stories, when I was in New Zealand, I got the idea and I thought, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could take that approach and use it in conjunction with our state tool? And that's what my research has been, is I found a way to help lighten the load of teachers so they can write these narratives or orally record it, right, using a device, and then they can connect it to their state tool. But the most powerful thing is that they use it to engage with families, and everybody is having a much deeper connection when they're using this storytelling type of approach.
Well, we're going to delve into that in the next segment, but one quick question now. I remember when I was from New York that there was a Even at fifth grade, there was this desire, how is my child going to test on the ERBs? How is my child going to get to the next step? Is the type of learning story system able to be as effective in gauging those things which these kids would unfortunately be tested on? Mm-hmm. And so you may end up with this wonderfully happy, well-developed kid that scores not very well in the ERB, and the parents will push back. So I sort of a, you know, unfortunate reality.
Yeah. So like I said, with learning stories, we use it in conjunction with the DRDP. The DRDP is what actually assesses the children. There's indicators or measures, and they're in specific domain levels. So when we write a learning story, we look for what are those indicators, and we still use the DRDP, and we score the child and get the reports to help measure that. But the learning story is a way that parents, it translates in a way that parents can understand the learning that occurs.
I understand. I think I understand. Good explanation. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Founded by a UCSB grad, Deckers Brands has grown into a global driver of lifestyle footwear from humble beginnings in 1973. Santa Barbara has been a key element of the business, defining the company's culture, providing home base for many employees, and inspiring product innovation each year. For a first-hand experience, stop by the Deckers Brands headquarters in Goleta, 250 Coromar Drive, from 10 to 7, Monday through Saturday, 11 to 5 Sunday, and shop their new brand showcase retail test lab. Guaranteed, you'll see a new side to Deckers' portfolio, from footwear to handbags to home furnishings.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Annie White, an assistant professor of early childhood studies at CSU Channel Islands, and we're talking about learning stories. So learning stories are a way to assess and communicate a child's development. Is that the short way of putting
it? Yes. It's used as an observation. So you're writing an observation. So a teacher can write it or a parent can write it. They're interchangeable, but you're writing what you observe the child do. So it's a written form of a document that you would write about the story. But what's so unique about learning stories is they're generally written to the child directly, not about the child. So I'd be writing a direct observation to you on what I saw, which becomes very much more personal. And what I find is that parents respond to it. So it's not something that's distant about a child. It's written directly to their child. And when a teacher writes the story, this learning story, to the child, they give it to the parent, or they email it or put it in Dropbox or whatever form it is. And the parent responds back to the child, not to the teacher. And so it creates this very incredible collaboration and partnership between teachers and parents. And often for older children, like preschool age and older, when the stories are written, because it's written to the child responds, and then the teacher includes that response. Often a co-teacher might want to contribute something because they were there or saw that. Even community members. So it includes multiple voices and multiple perspectives of what they observed that child doing.
And this is just for early childhood, or does it like in New Zealand, do they take it right through school?
Great question. Yes. In New Zealand, it does go through into the primary grades. And in New Zealand, it's used as their formative assessment for their early childhood across the country, but it's not required. But in the University of Massey recently did a research study and found that 98% of all teachers voluntarily do learning stories. So time is really precious. So you know it has to be something valuable if 98% of all the teachers use this assessment approach using, right, learning stories, it has to be something to it. And so what we did is here in the United States, there are pockets of people using learning stories. So, for example, here in Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, the child development centers with the early childhood programs, they're using learning stories in conjunction with their DRDP, their state tool. And they just went through a state audit recently and had glowing reviews.
And what about a teacher coming out of your system, and gets their first job in Santa Maria, and the school doesn't use it? Can that teacher bring it into this and get approval, or is there resistance?
Yeah, great. That's another great question. So many of the students graduating from our early childhood studies program they're very, very equipped to be able to do this method, and they're able to articulate it and take it to their programs. So they're infiltrating their programs already. They also know that they can have administrators contact us, for example, with me, and I do consultation and support local programs administering it. Adapting it and creating systems so they can use it. And before I came to Channel Islands at the university, the program was already using learning stories for at least 5 years. All of our curriculum assessment courses, we incorporate learning stories. We teach the teachers how to use that along with our state tool, the DRDP. But we don't just use it for our curriculum assessment courses. So, for example, I might teach a course on building reciprocal family networks. The students might have a course project where they write a learning story, but they write it to themselves, they send that to their family members or close friends, and they respond back to them. So the learning story approach is more than just writing a narrative observation. There's actually different components. One is writing the story, obviously, including photographs. So parents always love to be able to see what their child did. But then there's a section that's called the what it means section. And that's where the teachers document the significance of what they observed. And we here in California link that to our state foundations. The Department of Education already gave us guidelines. We have foundations that help us to frame and understand the learning in all the domains that happen in development. So the teachers will, when they do the observation, they actually will identify the learning. And that's like an educational piece. So parents then say, when my child was playing Play-Doh, what? They learned fine motor. There was sensory going on. There was cognitive development. There was language exchange. So it gives a context for parents to understand the learning. Then there's a section that's called opportunities and possibilities. And that section a teacher includes in the learning story is based on what they observed. What would they offer next in the curriculum to further support that learning, to scaffold, to build, to help that child continue to grow and to develop? What materials, what equipment, what activities, what would they do next? So it's their commitment. So it's all based on the observation, but a learning story is not just the observation. You have to have the interpretation, the reflection, and then from there, the analysis, what would you do and what would you offer next to that child?
So do you have an example?
Yes, I have a couple samples. So one sample is Henry's Bus, and that one is there is a former professor from Seattle, Tom Drummond, who has a website. For anybody who's interested, you can go to Tom Drummond's website, look up learning stories. He has a whole outline of how to do it and also samples. So I'm going to share a sample from his website, and it's a learning story about Henry's Bus. And Henry, this learning story was written within the first 2 weeks when he started the program there, which is often encouraged that you start off right when they start giving the first story should be about their transition into the program. So this one is particularly was written to the child, not written directly, but it was written about him. So there's different styles, but this one is from up in Washington. So it says, I was watching Henry as he came into the classroom to see what he would do. At first, he wandered around the room. Then he saw the bus and smiled, and he walked over to it and sat down. Teacher Dan. So it was a very simple, brief one. And I like this example to say some are just a couple sentences long. Some might be a page or two. The length will vary depending on what you observed. The what it means section, the next section, the teacher wrote, you know, and this is written directly to Henry. Henry, you know how to find comfort in what is familiar to you when you come to our school. So he's focusing on this transition and that the child was able to find comfort through this familiar object, this bus. And the opportunities and possibilities says, next time we will make sure the bus is available and add people and roads. We will find stories and pictures about buses to capitalize on your interest. And then there's the parent response. So the parent, this learning story was given, and the parent responded and said, "We are happy that Henry is able to comfort himself. It looks like his transition to the toddler class is going well. His brother likes buses and trains too. We're thrilled that you and all the teachers are willing to spend the extra effort to find books about Henry's interest, and you keep him occupied, happy, and learning. Thank you, Dad."
Wow.
So that's just one example, which would be very different. Often in early childhood programs with our assessment tools that we use, we write kind of these dry anecdotal observations, which they are used as evidence to rate, but we're finding that parents are not as connected. And part of what happened for me, I was working before I came to California State University, Channel Islands, I was working with a Head Start program in Northern California for almost 20 years. I was going out into the classrooms, and what I kept seeing over and over again is when the parents would leave the program, they'd get these portfolio binders with all those anecdotal observations, and they were throwing away all those sticky notes and keeping the photos. And that's when I realized there had to be a better way.
And, you know, I asked this question before, but now that you've read that, it seems to be even more more of something that confuses me, is that that's hard to do. It's hard to do in terms of being able to perceive a child in a very, you know, hectic moment where there's a lot of kids running around, and he was able to focus on an important moment for this child, mm-hmm. and then to write it in a coherent way. Mm-hmm. There's a great deal of skill besides, you know, knowledge about psychology that goes into that. And so when you want to scale this up to the whole country, I guess mm-hmm. that's one of your dreams. I just, you know, think, how can we really think that that universally these teachers can do this?
Yes, they can. We have New Zealand leading the way. There's other countries. There's Ireland and Australia and Kazakhstan. And there are so many countries currently using learning stories. And it makes sense because stories translate across all cultures. And believe it or not, when you write about something that's meaningful to you, it flows. It's so natural. And I have found that it doesn't matter that if it's a family child care provider, an infant toddler teacher, a preschool teacher, that this format is so easy and translatable, and that they don't have issues at all writing these stories because they're writing about something they care about. They're trained, they're professionals, and it makes visible their knowledge as professional educators.
I understand now why I found three shows that are being streamed on Netflix that are from New Zealand, and I understand them, and I never could understand why I like them so much. Now I get it. Maybe one day I'll be able to speak with a New Zealand accent. Would that help me write these stories?
Oh, I think that we are able to take this and translate it in our own culture, but I'm looking forward to, because I get to go back to New Zealand, I'm going with a team from California, and we're going to be doing a learning story intensive. We're the first team from the United States invited to study with Wendy Lee and the Educator Leadership Project. That's the leaders in training on learning stories in the country, and we're going to be leaving in October this year.
Great. You're listening to AHA Present About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
Available only at the company's headquarters in Goleta, the new Deckers brand showcase features the latest footwear from UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands. You're invited to stop by to experience firsthand what makes Deckers brand so unique. Discover new product and try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand at their retail stores. Now open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here with Dr. Annie White, Assistant Professor of Early Childhood Studies at CSU Channel Islands and a fellow at the Sims Mann Institute, which gives her even further credentials, not only a PhD, but also a fellow, which means that you are a neuroscientist by having the virtue of going to that presentation. Mm-hmm. And your Erica, the college president, is a neuroscientist. So yes. No wonder you CSU Channel Islands is at the forefront of this initiative.
I've been really fortunate with the university to have such support ever since I arrived on the campus there. They have supported my research and my interest on learning stories. I was able to receive grants from the university, the foundation funds, that also allowed me to take students to New Zealand to study. We were able to co-present study in New Zealand on learning stories and conducted undergraduate research. They presented when they came back to the community. They've also supported other projects. I was able to bring the renowned co-author of Learning Stories, Wendy Lee, to here, and she presented in Santa Barbara this past May, and also Ventura County. In here in Ventura County, we have incredible group of professionals that are very committed. There's the Early Education Leadership group that today they had a meeting and a presentation on learning stories. And part of some of the professionals in the community are going with me to New Zealand in October to continue our study. So it's very well received here, both in Santa Barbara County and Ventura County.
How are you going to teach if you go to New Zealand?
How do I get away?
How do you be able to teach here if you're going to be in New Zealand?
Oh, that's a great question. We use an LMS, a learning management system called Canvas. And half of my classes I teach online. And then the week that I'm gone in New Zealand, my courses are online. And so there is no break, no substitute. And we're communicating. And I blog to my students. And so they're learning right alongside me. Of course, my ultimate goal is to take a whole class. And I'm beginning to work on a project seeking funding so that I can take students in collaboration with San Francisco State University, who also incorporates learning stories. And then we'll co-take both of our students from both universities. And we're looking at doing this next year, next winter break. So I'm hoping to continue undergraduate research with the students on the learning stories approach.
What's so good about CSU Channel Islands is not just that it is the antithesis of a research institution that basically pays its teachers or rewards its teachers for publishing and really wants its teachers to teach. But as you have been doing, it also values research and it values innovation. And so the students get the best of both worlds. So here you are doing all this cutting edge work, but they still get you in the classroom.
Yeah, and also another part of our CSU Channel Islands is that we're very strong in interdisciplinary model. And so, for example, I was able to do a project with the libraries, and I was able to do an interdisciplinary with four other departments on our campus. And we did STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, activity, hands-on activities out in the library in the community. We actually won a best service or best practice awards 2 years in a row for my model. And my students do the learning stories when they're out doing the STEM activities in the community at the library and out in the schools. They're actually taking turn writing these observations and writing the learning stories, and then we give it back to the community. We just received another award for that. So there's so many incredible opportunities at our university. It's very progressive and very forward-thinking, and I'm so fortunate to be there because I'm able to help the students, I'm able to participate in the community, I'm able to strengthen the work that was already being done with learning stories.
Yes, but there's one negative to teach there. You've come from Alaska, and you don't have the same darkness, cold, wind. Are you able to deal with that here?
Yes, I remember I was in California first before there, and then I came back. But I actually currently live between Northern California and Southern California. So during the week, I'm here on campus, and I live close by. And then I have a home in Northern California, and I commute back. My family stays in the north because we have a home that's been in our family over 50 years. That's just an example of why I'm so committed to learning stories, because I know I can make a difference in the lives of teachers and children.
Well, thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much for all you do. I'm almost sorry I'm not 2 years old and I could learn better than I did before. This is HA Presents About Education. We've had Dr. Annie White with us today from CSU Channel Islands, and we'll be back here next week at the same time.